To make this episode, we asked you, our listeners, if you had any questions about a big life transition you were preparing for or in the middle of, where you needed some advice. What we got was this collection of questions that really trace the full life cycle of adulthood, from those of you starting out, where to live post-college, to questions wondering about kids and family size, and when to take a big risk for a creative dream. We heard about shakeups in your household and routines, how to trust after divorce, how to talk to a child becoming a young adult about sex and money, and how to cope when a sudden disability makes life as you've known it impossible. And we heard from you at the end of your careers, wondering when to retire, if a little more grinding work is worth more money in the long run, and also about how to find purpose when your working life is over. Thank you for sharing all of it and for reminding us that sometimes it really can be helpful to record a dispatch on what's troubling you and send it off to get help from a bunch of strangers. This is Death, Sex, and Money from Slate. I'm Anna Sale, and we have just learned how to use sound effects in our audio software, and we're so excited. This is the show about the things we think about a lot and need to talk about more. And at this very moment, I am about 7 months out from a big life reset. We've talked about it a lot on the show. You've probably heard. But Death, Sex, and Money had a near-death experience about 6 months ago, facing cancellation. We were not sure what was going to happen next to our show, to our jobs. And then Andrew Dunn, Zoe Azoulay, and I moved over to Slate with Death, Sex, and Money, where we now have new coworkers and new bosses, and each of us in our own way has had to figure out how much of a reset this could be in our attitudes toward work, our creative approach, our professional identities. And as we make this move, we are coming into a place that is a hotbed of life advice. Along with politics and cultural news, Slate has this universe of advice columns and podcasts. There's Dear Prudence and Karen Feeding for parenting questions, the podcast How to Do It, a sex advice column. So much happening here. And we have done advice shows at Death, Sex, and Money in the past, and we thought, as a part of us introducing you to the new people we get to work with in our new home at Slate, we thought we would bring together some of our Slate colleagues to take some of your life advice questions. These came in from Death, Sex, and Money listeners. And let me introduce the very game colleagues who have agreed to join us for this. First, I want to introduce you to Lizzie O'Leary. She's the host of What Next TBD, Slate's twice weekly news show about tech. Hi, Lizzie.
Hi, how are you?
Hi. I want to first ask you if you could describe the life phase you're in right now in just a few short words, what would you say?
Oof. I would say I am blending relatively new motherhood with midlife, which was a weird collision, and having just gone through cancer.
Yeah. Do you want to tell us a bit about your cancer treatment?
Sure. I was diagnosed with lung cancer in December, totally incidentally. It was found on a random scan. I have no, risk factors for lung cancer. I was super lucky. I was treated with surgery, and I'll be on medication for the next 3 years. And yeah, it's weird. It's the acute part is over, and the emotional understanding is just unfolding.
Well, welcome back to work.
Thanks.
And thanks for joining us while you're in that phase. Ronald Young Jr. is also here with us. He's the co-host of Slate's podcast, Working, Slate's podcast all about work. And you might also know Ronald from his work on the series he made called Wait For It, which is an autobiographical exploration of living in a big body that has won lots and lots of audio awards this year. Ronald, hello. Welcome to the show.
Hello, Anna. Great to be here.
Hello. Thanks for coming. And for you, in a few words, how would you describe the life stage you're in?
I would say that I am firmly in my second career. I'd say I'm about 5 to 6 years in right now. And I just turned 40. So I think the kids are saying that 40 is the new 30. So I just turned 30. And so, so I'm navigating my early 30s with the beginning of my second career. Thanks for asking, Anna.
I like that you're in midlife, but you're bringing that young energy because your early career, Ronald. So we're going to lean on you for that. And you made this career pivot. I think it's so cool. You worked as an IT consultant. You had worked in audio for a number of years. But in 2018, you went to an audio conference and vowed to yourself within 2 years you would be doing this full time. Were you able to meet that goal?
I was 34 and I went to this audio conference and I said, you know what, I'm going to be doing this full time within 2 years. And 2 years came and the pandemic began and I had to keep that vow to myself in a very tough time. But fortunately,
the pandemic held you to it.
Exactly. I definitely kept the vow.
And also with us is Mark Joseph Stern, who is a senior writer at Slate covering legal issues and lots of other things. Welcome, Mark.
Thank you so much. Happy to be here.
And Mark, how about you? What life stage are you in?
I am in the stage of our six-month-old son woke us up 3 times last night. Whoa. And if I sound even semi-coherent today, I will consider that a win. Does that count as a stage?
It definitely does. You are in sleep regression stage. I'm hearing that.
I will. If I had to put a label on it, it would be the point when your baby is old enough that you go out in public and see babies who are younger and get to go up to the parents and be like, oh, I remember when mine was at that age. Oh, yeah, 2 months. What a precious age. Mine is a six-month-old now, so I'm a seasoned veteran of parenthood. And I've got lots of tips if you want them. But just enjoy the moments, you know? That's where I'm at.
A seasoned elder parent 6 months in. Yes. And Lizzie, how old is your child?
He will be 4 in July.
Okay,
so
4.
He's like very proudly announcing that he's 3 3/4.
All right. Well, I've got a 5 and 7-year-old. If you all have any advice while we go through, I have been through it. I want, before we go to our first listener question, I want to understand for each of you when you think in your life you took the biggest jump that felt like an opt-in life reset where you bet on yourself. Lizzie, do you have one of those?
I actually have 3, but I'll do them really quickly.
Okay.
My first, I had a terrible time graduating from college. I loved college. It was amazing. I kind of self-actualized. Mm. And I fell apart when I graduated. Completely miserable, like totally legitimately depressed. It was awful. But I took a chance and went to New Hampshire to work for Bill Bradley's presidential campaign.
Oh!
I was a volunteer, and then I stuck around, and they started paying me. But what I found was that I was really interested in what the journalists were doing. And I started kind of following them around and absorbing what they were doing, and that led to my curiosity, and one of them helped me get a job in journalism afterwards. Numbers 2 and 3 are more personal. I had terrible endometriosis, and after one of my surgeries, I decided to freeze my eggs. It was 2012. The technology was still pretty new, but that was a real bet on kind of myself and the ability to go through the next part of my professional life without freaking out about fertility.
Were you partnered at the time when you did that?
No, I wasn't. It actually made dating easier because I wasn't sizing up. I'm a straight woman. I wasn't sizing up every man within 5 minutes. Like, yes, no, yes, no, no. Okay. I was much more chill. And then the third thing was I went on a blind date in 2017 and met my husband. I hate being set up. And I was just sort of grudgingly said, like, yes, fine, I will do it. And I met the man I'm now married to.
Okay, Lizzie bringing some clutch life reset moments. Mark, can you compete with any of Lizzie's?
No, absolutely. I was told this wouldn't be a competition, Anna.
Sorry.
We're supposed to be like warm and loving here.
Sorry. I do love that Slate is not a competitive work. I am a middle child, though, so this is a tendency of mine I'm trying to let go of.
Okay, we'll work
on that.
But Mark,
tell us your own. There's no contest here. Tell us a life phase. At what age you made a decision that felt big?
I mean, not to be like redundant and obvious, but I think it was deciding to have children with my husband when I was 28. He's 6 years older than I am. So he was at kind of a different phase in life. And I felt like maybe I was still too young. We had gotten married when I was 27. But he pointed out, and this is true, that for gay people, like, kids don't just happen. And of course, they don't just happen for many, many heterosexual couples as well. But like, there are a lot of steps in the process, and the steps are complicated and awkward and sometimes expensive. And I had a lot of hangups about that. But eventually I was like, you know what? I'm just going to have to take the dive in and start doing this and be maybe like a younger dad than I had envisioned, because I chose to marry someone who's a little bit older. And I have to respect that, like, he's at a place where it's time to have kids. And I am so glad that I did.
So how old were you when your son came into your life?
So I was 32 when he was born. So it did end up being quite a long journey, but it was a good time for me. You know, by the time we were there, I felt really ready.
Thanks, Mark. And Ronald, you told us about a decision in 2018 to set a goal for yourself. Is there another life phase, another moment at what age that you made a big decision that felt consequential?
Well, I think, I mean, not to return back to that well, but it was for me, I just want to point out that for me at age 36, when I lost the job that I had, like in the middle of the pandemic, there was a moment there where my now ex-girlfriend said to me, I said to her, like, this is it. I'm full-time audio production now. I'm just moving forward. I'm broke, whatever, but this is what I'm going to do. This is the best time to do it. I'm not going to look for an IT job. And I remember she said to me, she goes, well, you know, and if that doesn't work, you can always find another IT job. And that's kind of probably when I knew that this relationship wasn't going to make it. Because at that point, I was like, my bet's on myself. I'm believing in myself right now. And once I figured that out in my mind, I knew I was going forward. And I thought, she's probably not going to come with me. And we broke up probably a couple of weeks after that. So it was that was probably the moment where I just was like, this is what I'm doing now. And whoever's going to be with me is going to be with me at that point moving forward. And that was just the mindset that I had at that point.
Let's go to our first listener question, which is a moving question. This comes from a listener named River, who is an almost college graduate from the Pacific Northwest.
Hi there. I'm 22. I'm about 2 months away from graduating from college, and I'm struggling to decide between staying in the city that I go to college in after graduation, or if I'm going to be moving back to my slightly smaller hometown, home city, which is about 2 hours away from where I go to school. My whole family lives there. My extended family lives there. And I always sort of had these plans to move back home after I was done with school. And now I have this opportunity to keep living with the roommates that I've lived with for the past 2 years. And it's really appealing. Financially, staying in either city is going to cost about the same amount of money. I'm not going to have any issues getting a job in either city. And something that worries me a little bit about moving back home is that I might lose sort of the feeling of independence that I've gained by being farther away from my family. And I'm wondering if the trade-off of being near my parents and extended family and potentially feeling a little smothered by them is worth having the ability to really engage in that relationship and get to know them better. I really value having an adult relationship with my parents and my extended family. It's something I want to continue cultivating, but I don't know if that's something that I would benefit from cultivating from farther away or in the same city. And I feel the clock ticking. I think I could benefit from some advice from people who are not directly involved in my life, because everyone that I usually go to for advice either wants me to stay in the city I go to school in, or they want me to go back to my hometown.
I really appreciate this question from River, because I hear there at the end that he is being aggressively lobbied by two different camps. Who has some thoughts for River?
I guess I just first want to jump in and say at 22, what you think you hear is a clock ticking. That's not a clock. That whatever it might yes. be a bomb, you know, might be someone making annoying noises with their mouth. It's not a clock. When you're 22, you don't even know the clock exists. This is my understanding of Einstein's theory of relativity, is that in your 20s, you do not grasp the concept of time in the same way that you will later.
Yes.
So I guess my first thought immediately is just like, please take a deep breath and eat a gummy and like spend some self-care yes. time reminding yourself that you are a young, young man with like a whole life ahead of you, and that like, you shouldn't even have any clocks in your house, man. Get rid of them.
Yes.
Get rid of your clocks, River. Who else has some advice?
I absolutely agree. I think that I think what bothers me is that when I think about the decisions that I was making at 22, 23, is I thought all of them were so permanent at the time. Mm-hmm. Like I thought everything that I did at 22, 23 was going to be the rest of my life. And had I known then how many times I could have been like making mistakes, doing dumb stuff, living places that I could not afford, like sleeping on people's couches, all of that stuff that I could have been doing at 22, 23, but thinking that I couldn't because I had to get a job. I had to start a living. I had to be, you know, ready for a relationship, all of that. And I think at 22, 23, you should do the thing in front of you that is making you happy. And if that's being in your apartment with your friends, then do that. If it's going home, if that's what you want to do, that will still be there likely in years to come. If you're 22, you could also do that at 32.
But it's also pressure, right? Like you yeah. can hear at the end of that voicemail, the pressure from all the different sides and the pressure from inside. I mean, I just said I had a terrible time at 22 because I felt so much pressure from myself to make a big decision about like my life with capital letters. And I had absolutely no effing idea what to do with my life. Like you don't have to know. It's okay not to know. You will make big mistakes. And there are like windows and doors open everywhere that you didn't see.
What I want you to think about, River, is what I do think you get to pick up in your 20s is this is giving you information about the building blocks that are important to you in a in your whole adult life. Like whether you go home or whether you stay in an apartment with your friends, like what I'm hearing is like you appreciate having adult relationships, not just with your family of origin, but your whole extended family. Like that's good information to have. And whether you live in the same town with them ever again, you can build a life where those relationships are something really that you tend to and nurture. But the stakes of this decision coming at graduation, I think, maybe are lower than how it feels. You do have to make a decision, but it's not a decision that is permanent.
And I think that's really beautiful and well put. You have provided such nuanced thoughts. And I guess I just want to come barreling in through the wall with like the correct answer, which is that you should stay in the city. You should not move back
yes.
in with your family.
Yes.
That's just FYI.
Plus one.
Just FYI, River.
Yes.
That's the right answer.
Yes.
Now, you can take everything we're saying and apply it and choose the wrong answer because being young is also about making mistakes. But that would be a mistake because you're 22. You don't know it, but you have a flexibility, like a willingness to tolerate a remarkable amount of stuff that as you get older, you will lose. And that is the time to live in a city and have fun and tolerate roommates. So personally, I think that objectively, you should stay put.
Personally is objectively.
Yes.
And River, if you choose the other choice, that's okay. You should tell us and I won't tell Mark. Let's go to the next question from Emily, who is in her 30s, a different life phase, and lives in Connecticut.
Hi. I'm calling about a decision that millions of people have made, which is whether or not to have kids, but more specifically, on having multiple kids. My husband and I are in the process of deciding whether or not to have a second. Our son is 2, which seems to be the age to make the decision about having another. And I spend a lot of time around other parents socially, like at the playground, stores, kids' museums. And I pay really close attention to the dynamics of those families with multiple kids, mostly in an attempt to help me solidify the decision in my own head. And it seems like they're all completely miserable, like tired, irritable, stressed, making sly remarks about how awful kids are. But so many have multiple kids. I kind of expected the decision about going from 1 to 2 to be much easier than the decision about going from 0 to 1, because you kind of know what to expect at that point. But for me, it seems to be a lot harder. So I'm curious about what goes into the decision to have multiple kids. Like, does it just get bad once there's more than one? If it's so miserable, why does everyone do it? Like, there's definitely a societal expectation to have lots of kids for no, like, truly legitimate reason. And I just can't help but think it's just this biological drive to procreate that's driving everyone to absolute misery.
Okay, I'll come in with my 2 kids experience a little further in. But Ronald, I'm curious, what do you think as someone who is not a parent? What do you think the going from 1 to 2? What advice do you have?
Listen, I didn't know that we're allowed to say what the right or wrong answer is. So I just want to start there. So coming to me first is probably a mistake because I don't have kids. I'm going to say this and I'm going to shut up, which is that, like, what I'm always told is that at one point you're playing man to man and then you go zone when you go from 2 to 3. So I think for me, 2 has always been the max number. It's like if there's 2 parents in the house, you're still doing one-on-one defense. So I feel like maybe you just have as many kids as there are parents in the home. I know relationships take all different forms, but that's just me. I have 0 kids. So I would take everything I said with a grain of salt.
Okay, and Lizzie and Mark, I don't know where you are in this question. Is 1 child, has that been a decision that each of you have made? Has that been where you've landed and have ambivalence about it?
In my case, it's, I think, where we've landed because of age and living in New York City. And, you know, I'm 48. Like, yeah, my grandma had a baby when she was 47, but that was like a Catholic whoops. I think that we're done at 1, even though there are things where I'm like, oh, my son's gonna be an only child and that's tough. And so I like push him into socializing opportunities where, you know, maybe with his cousins, where he has to share and he has to be accommodated and all those things. I think this woman wants another baby, by the way. I don't know. I do think that the like defensive parent thing, when you hear people talk about how miserable they are, some of that is real, but some of that is also, there's like an awkwardness to it. You don't want to admit that your heart has exploded and it's amazing.
I think some of it is hazing too. This is something I noticed when we were waiting for our son to be born, that people who already had kids were like, it's the worst thing that will ever happen to you.
You'll never sleep.
They're going to ruin your life. And it's just hazing and it's just like passed on. I don't like the cycle, but that's how the cycle is. And so I think that the caller here, I think that Emily should take all of that as Lizzie said, with a big grain of salt. We are considering a second for a lot of reasons. I mean, 1, I almost hate to say this, but I will. I find people who grew up as only children tend to annoy me in ways,
damn it,
in ways that are like distinctive and like repeat over large sample sizes. Like they tend to be like more kind of self-centered, more convinced that they are the planet around which all of the others orbit, struggle to, I think, just intuitively take other people's like thoughts and needs and feelings into account. Like that's just something I've noticed across friends. And I have a lot of friends who are only children. I'm certainly hoping none of them listen to this episode. but I really do think that Julian my son will be a more irritating adult if we don't saddle him with a sibling.
This is why I shove my child into all of these situations where he has to make compromises.
I think you can fight. I totally think you can solve for this if you're really vigilant about it. Just to Emily's actual question, where that leads me is you should just wait and see how you feel. Like, you don't need to force yourself into a decision. I don't see any external or internal pressures here. You're just like, should I do it or not? Well, just sit on it. Wait, you know, maybe it happens, maybe it doesn't. But like, you know, you will be the one to make that decision and know whether it's right, and nobody else will.
I would just, for me, my experience was, I think when I thought, do I have a second baby? It's like, do I want to do newbornhood again? And to me, what my experience of having a second kid was like, do I want to be raising a rambunctious child who needs a lot of physical management while holding a baby? Because that's more what it's like. It's like, yeah, I'm nursing and I'm trying to keep the 3-year-old from like jumping off the top of the slide at the same time. And I guess what I would say, to me, I thought choosing to become a parent was going to be this switch that I flipped and then the decision was going to be made. But I felt like, for me, I could like still access my pre-parent self when I had one. It was easier. And when I had two, it was like a bomb went off and I was just in this crazy gauntlet for 3 years until they both could put on their shoes by themselves. And so it's like a temporary gauntlet in the hardness of the early years. And now it's so fun to be downstairs and hear them upstairs in their room giggling together. Like, so much so that when I see a fellow mom at elementary school who's pregnant with their third or even fourth, I look at them and I think, I have such envy, I can't even like think about it. It's because in our lives, when Arthur and I talked about whether we wanted to have a third kid, it was like, we could, but we would have to change the whole enterprise. Like, we both couldn't have the same jobs that we have. We'd have to figure out childcare in a whole new way. But I still look at those parents who get to have three, and I think, oh, it's so fun to have siblings.
And I had one of my friends who is a parent said, Ronald, if you have three, you might as well have 300. Because at that point, it doesn't even matter anymore. So when you said that, when you talked about third and fourth, I'm
surrendering.
Like, yeah.
Surrendering. Yeah, it's like this unit is the whole thing that's my life. Like, you're really going in. But in some ways that I think is like kind of cool. Okay, we're going to make a hard turn from family life and go back to the professional realm with a question from Gio, who's a photographer in Philadelphia in his 30s. Let's hear his question.
I've reached a level of exhaustion with the politics of the industry that I work in, of the, you know, the racism that a lot of Black and brown people are facing in making our work and getting our work exhibited and made into books and taken seriously. So I've been stepping away from photography a bit, and I would like to try to move to Los Angeles to make a feature film. In 2020, Miramax reached out to me and wanted me to make a screenplay for one of my essays. And I did this and they didn't buy it. Everybody from the Miramax team who I worked with left, but I was left with this script about a very personal story of a friend of mine who took his life when I was a child, and when he was a child, an fictionalized version of the story. And I want to try to move to Los Angeles and use whatever small connections I have. And it's just an unspeakably large move. All of my family is in Baltimore. All of my chosen family is really in New York. And this is yet another industry with a predatory anti-Black history that is quite substantial and quite difficult to navigate. So I'm in the phase of this reset. I'm comfortable right now, and I'm wondering, do I uproot my physical comfort and peace to go try to make it in this very, very difficult to survive in industry/city and try to get this film made and honor this person's life?
I love this question. There's a lot in here. Ronald, do you have thoughts about this? Having made a big creative pivot in your own life, what would you tell Gio?
I mean, I think you gotta make the thing, like whatever it is. If it's eating at you and you have the chops to do it, I think you should do whatever you can to actually make the thing. That's how Wait For It got made. You know, I bootstrapped it and decided that it needed to get made after losing opportunities to work with, you know, bigger companies. After losing those opportunities, I realized that I had to do it independently. So I think, like for me, whenever I hear somebody has an idea, I'm always kind of like thinking in terms of what is the quickest way for them to get from idea to actual prototype, to actual get this thing to actually exist. So, I mean, the toughest part about it is really what gets you more opportunities is being creative and making things. Like if you write that book, write that script, make that podcast, whatever that is, typically that's going to be the thing that opens the doors to get you even further into the rooms of where you want to go. So I think it's tough because he is talking about industries that are historically anti-Black and that are difficult for folks like us to navigate. And to be clear, it's also anti-queer and anti-women in a lot of cases too. So it's not like it's easy for anyone to navigate. But for him in particular, I would say, you know, go in with your eyes wide open, make the thing you want to make, and don't forget why you're going. You're going because you want to make this specific project. Make the project and then see what doors open after that.
And for you, when you decided to make the thing in your life, did you feel like you needed to move to be closer in proximity to the gatekeepers? Because what Gio's also asking is, should I move to LA because I want to do this? And for you, how did you think about that question? Do I need to be closer to where the power centers are?
Well, I live in Alexandria, Virginia, and I was actually contemplating a move to LA very recently. I had gone through a breakup and I'm like, you know what? Friends are moving to LA. There's opportunities out there. And the reason why I decided not to move to LA was for two reasons. One, I took a train trip to New York. I took the Acela train to New York. And I realized that an Acela train to New York is like 2 hours and 30 minutes. It's like 2 hours and 40 minutes. It's very short. You could be in New York. You could say, I want to be in New York right now and be in New York by noon. It's great. That's one. And then two, it occurred to me that like, I want to go to LA when the opportunities are already open. I don't want to have to go to LA and do all the hustling that I've done already here in DC to create like a community and a name for myself here to have to go and restart all that work in LA. I'd love to go with a thread of an opportunity. And I feel like if that doesn't happen, then I could just continue working harder, making projects here and continue to parlay the opportunities that I have in front of me into bigger ones. So yes, I think about like the move to the closer places, but I also think about like, what does it mean to make work wherever you are? If you're in Des Moines, Iowa, what does it mean to put Des Moines, Iowa on the map? Do you have to move to LA to do whatever the thing is? I think in some cases the answer is yes. And I know this is not satisfying, Anna, but I think it really comes down to the individual and saying like, what does that mean for you to make that move or to stay where you are? Can you get stuff done where you are?
Lizzie, you've made some moves for professional opportunity. What do you think about this?
I have. And I guess some of it depends on how much you need to physically have the coffee, take the meeting, like show up and be in somebody's face. Obviously, we as a society need to do less of that now. I mean, here are the four of us having a digital conversation. We're all in different places. But I do think there is some value in being in the place where the thing is made. I don't actually think it has to be LA. Like, I think you could do it from New York. And I think that in a hard industry, it helps actually, like I'm, you know, Gio says all of my chosen family is really in New York. That also is important. Like you're fighting battles in a tough industry, it actually helps not to feel alone.
Mm. Yes.
To have the people who support you be able to pick you up after a day when someone has said no and you feel really low.
And I wonder about it. I'm interested that LA seems like it's calling Gio. And I wonder about, can you spend 6 weeks in LA?
That's like, a great idea.
Are there ways you could sublet your place and just take a trip and see how it feels? It doesn't have to be an either or situation. Mark, anything you want to add?
Well, your suggestion really speaks to me because as my meek silence might suggest, I am like extremely risk averse, and just hearing this question kind of gave me hives. I have lived in DC since I was 18. I knew that I wanted like to do what I'm doing now when I was 19, and I've been doing it and I love it and I sort of never want to stop. And so hearing these amazingly brave ideas about totally uprooting in pursuit of a dream, like, it's incredible, but it's super duper not me. And so I feel that my ability to provide advice is really hampered by my own like deep gnawing need for stability. So I love the idea of going there for like 6 weeks, get an Airbnb, sublet or something, like see what your first 6 weeks would be like if you did move there. Try to kind of conceptualize it that way. The other thing that really leapt out to me from this question is that it sounds like the individual Gio is a writer first and foremost, and it's not super clear to me why he decided to envision this as a screenplay, but he speaks about writing essays and that this was a screenplay that was adapted from one of his essays. And I wonder if, you know, now that he's gone through all of this with Miramax and it's fallen through, he wouldn't consider possibly reconceptualizing it as something like a novel, which is, you know, the publishing industry is not that much better than the movie industry in terms of all of the bad things that Gio flagged. But I do think that you can work on a novel without uprooting your life and needing to make those connections with gatekeepers that you were talking about, Anna.
I love all of this advice, and I thank you for bringing in the risk-averse side into this, because I'm with you.
Yeah, I'm like, you, Mark, sit at home, don't open your door, write a novel, never leave.
Okay, now we've got, this is an interesting relational advice question. This is from a listener we're calling Hector.
I'm a 40-ish-year-old car salesman with a philosophy degree and a parent of two teenagers. And the transition of them, you know, one graduating high school and leaving the house this year has got me up at night sometimes trying to think about how our relationship can change to where I can still have some effect on the choices he makes for the better, hopefully, especially in terms of money and sex as he goes away to school, but in a way that he'll accept, or that we can develop our relationship so that we can be, I want to be a trusted advisor, but it's hard because, you know, he doesn't want to talk about sex and he doesn't really want to talk about money. So it's all these adult things he needs to start thinking about and dealing with, and trying to get him to listen or to discuss it is very hard because it's just so awkward for him to talk to dad about anything like that. So that's what's on my mind.
I, first of all, Hector, I am so into the way you self-identify as a car salesman in his 40s with a philosophy degree. I just think this paints such a picture. What do you all hear in Hector's question there? What would you say to him?
It's so hard to think about your kids out in the world without you. That, like, you know, even if you're not a shield in an active way that you might be when someone is little, the idea of them being there without you to turn to is terrifying. You know, I have a 3-year-old, so I can't think about how difficult it is to have teenagers. But one thing that I'm struck by here is talking to the kids about sex and money. And I wonder about trying to flip that around and talking to them about what they like to do or their friends or something else, and then just kind of asking the question, what do you think about sex at college? Are you worried about that? Does that seem exciting or scary? And then waiting and dealing with the awkwardness and then trying again in a few weeks, because no conversation that's this important is going to be one and done. It's like a very long process of trying to break through teenage defenses, think about what you've modeled, and let them know that you're a safe person to come to, even if they're going to say something or do something that might not be your first choice.
I agree. And I struggle probably with this question mostly because my parents were very strict growing up. And for us going off to college, they really wanted to have like some sense of remote control over our decisions, which felt tough because what it did was it made it so that me and my sister lied to our parents a lot about what was going on, or we withheld information up through our current age, where it's just like, we're just not going to tell them that because we know that they're going to have, their opinion is going to be, you did the wrong thing. It's not going to be, here's some guidance. It's, you did the wrong thing. And I think when I think about fostering a relationship with even teenagers that aren't mine, even like any of that, I always want to be able to give them space to make the wrong decision and hope that they learn the lesson themselves, rather than me straight up having to tell them that you did the wrong thing and they're afraid to come to me because of that type of judgment, you know? And I think that is the best relationship that you could probably cultivate with an adult child, which is that, and if you want to come to me for advice, for guidance, I'm here to do that, but I'm not going to judge you just because you made a decision that I wouldn't make.
And I love, Ronald, that use of remote control. I've never heard of that phrase used in that way. And it's so evocative to think about parents wanting to have remote control over their children.
Yeah.
Mark, what did you want to add?
I'm wondering if this is the first time that he's tried to talk about sex and money with his kids, and particularly with the child who's graduating and leaving the house, because it kind of sounds like it is. And in that case, I think it's perfectly understandable that the reaction would not be super positive, that, oh, now you're 18, I'm going to sit you down and talk to you about like condoms and 401ks. And so I wonder if that's the case, like, is maybe the better approach to sort of say, hey, you know, I know that I should have had these conversations with you earlier, and I'm sorry that I didn't. We should have been talking about this, about issues like sexual pleasure and consent and, you know, building a life and financial planning. I mean, I would probably kind of separate out the sex and the money parts of this. Money probably a little easier to talk about. But, you know, it might be worth saying this should have happened before. You know, I was never taught how to be a parent, but let's work this through now.
Interesting. You're making me realize, Mark, if my parents had said, like, before I left for school, I'm just going to show you how I pay bills once a month and where the money goes. Like, what? That would have been amazing.
Yeah.
And not something that was part of my family culture. And it's made, I mean, even now in my 40s, like when I have to ask my mom a money decision question, I'm kind of like, sorry, I don't know this, but I have this question of how you do this, you know, and just to model like, here's how I do it. There's lots of ways to do this.
You know, what really helped me out here with this is when my dad and I sat down when I was in high school to watch E2 Mama Tambien together. That one sparked some great conversations and I'll remember them forever. And I'll just leave it at that.
Oh, sexy foreign films as a gateway.
I saw The Piano with my mom in high school and I was scarred forever.
I saw The Piano with my dad in a movie theater.
And we walk out and my mom's like, Harvey Keitel is the sexiest man I've ever seen.
I watched one episode of Game of Thrones with my parents and I was ruined forever, so...
Our next question comes from Elizabeth, who is 45 and lives in California. And it's about how to know when you're ready to try again. Let's listen to what her question is.
My story is that I'm now 45 years old. And shortly after I turned 40, I had a 1-year-old and a 3-year-old. And at bedtime one evening, my husband told me that he was planning to move out. It was really the first trauma of my life. I think I lived in a state of unreality for quite some time. This was also 2019, and within a year, we had entered a global pandemic, and my daughter had been diagnosed with autism. So I was in the trenches of massive life changes for quite a while. That feels like it's in the rearview mirror now. I have a new partnership with somebody I feel so safe and comfortable and well suited to be with. He has a child of his own, and I have to address now whether I can trust in the way that I did when I married. And if I can't trust in the same way, what might be a new way to trust a partner to come in so close to my life, to share a home, to blend the culture of his family system and mine, to put three children from different parents under one roof, whether to blend finances. There's lots of decisions within the decision.
Oh, Elizabeth, this is a big one. I guess I would offer, I grew up in a blended family. My dad had kids with his first wife before he married my mom, and they had kids. And I can remember as a child kind of saying to myself, like, oh, I think I want to marry a divorced dad because I want my kids to get to have older half-sisters the way I do. Like, it's such a cool way to grow up. And I think it makes me think about, for you, Elizabeth, this question of, like, how am I going to trust? Like, I think there's a question of trust when you decide to marry and blend a family and share a household. But maybe more fundamental to that is your sense of the values that you and your new partner share and what is the family culture that you're excited to explore with this new partner. Because I don't think, you know, you've been through this trauma that shows you, like, there's no guarantees. But there is something kind of beautiful about having been through what you've been through. You're probably pretty clear-eyed about some bedrock things that are important to you about the kind of household you want to have for your kids and for a relationship. And so I would sort of start there for those questions of, like, I don't know, whether to share finances, how to deal with the kids coming together. Like, you know, what excites you about sharing your life with this new partner, and talk about that.
I also grew up in a series of blended families. I at one point had steps. I have halves on both sides. And I married pretty late. And my husband also comes from sort of a blended family. And when we married in our 40s, and I have not been through the breakup of my own household, but I have been through it a few ways with parents. And, you know, those scars are there for a long time, and they do affect the way you trust people. And being married at 42, we both came to that marriage with long romantic histories, with formed adult personas, and a lot of emotional scar tissue. And I think that trust builds very slowly, especially if you have been through a lot of life. You know, falling in love in your 40s is not the same as falling in love in your 20s. It's a much more, in some ways, unsettling and cautious process.
Yeah.
This strikes me as one of those questions where the person has already done most of the heavy lifting and just might not realize it because it was so exhausting. You know, Elizabeth asks, if I can't trust in the same way, what might be a new way to trust? And that's her only real question. But, you know, she's already trusted herself to strike it out on her own after her husband cruelly left her. She made it through the pandemic with her two kids. She made it through an autism diagnosis and everything that follows. She's found a new partnership already, and she loves him, and she seems ready to blend their families together. And I, like, I think that she's already figured out this new way to trust and she's in it right now. And maybe because she's in it, she doesn't see it. But it sounds like, you know, odds are pretty good, Elizabeth, that you've kind of cracked this nut. I was thinking when I started this question, it was going to end with something like a deep uncertainty about your next move or a kind of deep fear about this happening again. And of course, that's going to be there in the back of everyone's mind forever. And I think it'll be an issue for you since you've experienced the pain of a walkout like that. But you found a new man who sounds really great. And I think if you can trust yourself to make it this far and you can trust him to enter your life in the way that he has, then whatever step you take next will almost certainly be the right one.
I love all these answers. Our next listener has a question that's very clear, and I'm very interested to hear what you all think Nick should do. Let's listen to his question. Nick is 57 and lives in Southern California.
Death, sex, and money, I need some advice. I could retire in about 2 years, or I could retire today. But if I wait, I'll have a much higher pension. But on the other hand, I'm stressed out and tired and aggravated and don't know if I can make it the next 2 years. What should I do?
Okay, a very clear question. I'm going to give you some more context that we got from a written email. Nick works as a public defender, and there's sort of a sense of aloneness. He says, the people I work with are not typically working collaborative with me and my client. And then he talks about the stress and the sadness, feeling overwhelming at times, causing sleepless nights, stomach and chest pains, shortness of breath, physical symptoms of anxiety. On the other hand, he says it's rewarding to help individuals. It's rewarding to persuade others, but there must be a tipping point between my health and more money. And then he adds, there's really nothing I can do to make as much money as I do now. After all these years, I'm well paid and well regarded. But I thought by now I'd have the stress figured out and mastered, but I don't. And these are critical years for my pension, and it's hard to find the right balance. Mark, as the most risk-averse of our panelists, what is your advice for what to do?
First of all, props for being a public defender, hero of the Constitution. We love the Sixth Amendment saviors. Thank you. Thank you. Nick, we appreciate you. I first read this and thought, well, too bad, you're going to have to stick it out because you need that money and it sounds like you don't really have a plan B. Now, rereading it, thinking through it maybe a little more carefully, I'm struggling because the risk-averse approach, I'm not sure which it is, right? Mm. I think if you keep going, you're saying you're having physical manifestations of your strain and exhaustion. I mean, you could be looking at some real serious health problems if you keep up the pace. You don't want to have a heart attack in the middle of your office and die before you get to cash out that pension and go live la vida loca, right? At the same time, you seem like you're very concerned about financial stability. And if you don't stay put, it sounds like you might be worried about being able to remain comfortable through your retirement. It's really tough. I wish that I had even more information to try to suss out some kind of middle ground, but I would be inclined to see if what you can do is basically say to your supervisor, look, I'm a public employee. I've done my work. I've got way too many cases on my docket. The sad reality is that public defenders in every jurisdiction in this country are overwhelmed. We don't put enough money toward public defense. And I understand that a lot of PDs feel like I have to take on as many clients as I can because otherwise they might be sitting in pretrial detention for months and months before they even see a lawyer. I get that. But I think that, you know, at this point, Nick, you need to take a little bit more of your own health and your needs under advisement and set that aside and recognize that you've done great work for decades. And now it's time to say, I need fewer clients. I need fewer cases. I need less time in the courtroom. I am looking at my retirement and I want to make it there. It's 24 months away. I don't want to have a heart attack before that happens, but I want to get to that finish line. And that means you all in the office, you all above me, you need to treat me with more respect, more seniority, and let me take a breather and live these last 2 years of my job with a little bit of a lighter pace.
Mark, I don't know if you know this from your proximity to the legal system. Is it possible for a public defender to, like, take medical leave without there being a bunch of clients who get the shaft?
Yeah, absolutely.
Ronald, what do you want to add?
Well, I was going to say, I agree with every single thing that Mark said. I think my approach would be different. I would say, first of all, go get a physical. Go get a physical right now. Just see how everything's going,
like
see
now.
How you feel, all of that. Yeah, just go get one. See how you're feeling. And then once you've assessed that physical, I would say coast the next 2 years, sit in the chair, do the job that you can. And I feel like the biggest problem, especially with a job like this, is that your assumption is that it all comes down to you. But the truth is you are fighting a system. It's not you fighting the individual court battles of all of these people. You are fighting against a system that is kind of designed to oppress and keep people in pretrial detention or keep people like from actually getting their due justice. And there's only so much that you can do if you realize that you don't have that much control. Do the best job you can for the clients that you can. And if that load means two clients or as small as that is, then do the job you can for those clients and don't ask for any extra work. I guess the millennial way of saying this, or what they're calling it now, is quiet quitting, but just do what you can from 9 to 5 after getting your physical and get out of there. Get that money, man. That's 2 years. Get that money. That's going to pass real quick, man. You're going to need it too.
Such a great point. Yeah.
The other thing that I would offer Mark is I think that the thinking you're doing is important for, like, no matter when you retire, you're going to have, it sounds like the way that you have been feeling like you're holding so much on your own individual shoulders for your clients, you're going to have to at some point figure out how to separate from that, because. And so I think maybe taking vacation, if you feel like this anxiety is it sounds like it's debilitating. Mental health is health, and you can think about a medical leave if that's what you need. But this is like taking care of yourself is practice for the kind of disentangling that retiring is going to take, no matter when you do it. So it's good to start exploring that now. And no matter what, 26 years of public defending, you've put in a lot of time, and you've done a lot of service, and you should feel really proud. This next question from a listener named Tom is also about living in our bodies and what happens when how we move around the world changes. Let's listen to Tom's question.
I'm almost 50. For reasons that confound my doctors, I developed an illness where it isn't safe for me to drive. I went from being an active, vibrant, if older, guy who could do pretty much anything I wanted to being effectively homebound and unable to do much overnight. Uber and Lyft exist, but going most anywhere will be $50 or more. Our neighborhood doesn't have sidewalks. My wife works full time. She has her own life that doesn't include being my chauffeur. In the beginning, friends volunteered to drive me places, but that dried up pretty quickly. I can't get to and from an in-person job, and I was laid off from my last job. I tried to find a remote job for a while, but frankly, it got too depressing, and I mostly stopped trying. Will this whole liminal state ever end? Before my demise, will I ever work again? Or is my life destined to be shuffling around the house in my slippers, wondering if I'll ever get better? The doctors don't know, and there's apparently not much that they or I can do about it. I never really appreciated how important driving was until I couldn't do it. A friend once said to me, "Sex is like air. You don't think about it until you're not getting enough." This is a similar sort of thing if you just replace sex with driving.
That last thought is like, oh, sex and driving. I've never thought about that comparison. Lizzie, I wonder, having just gone through your own experience of having your body change in ways you didn't expect and that requiring you to change your life, what would you say?
I would say that it's exceptionally hard. I, you know, not just the cancer, but I have an autoimmune disease that took years to diagnose. And before that, I had endometriosis that took years to diagnose. And so I understand that liminal state of what is happening to me? Why is my body betraying me? What do all of these things mean? And that state is incredibly psychologically taxing. It's physically very difficult, but it's incredibly psychologically taxing and really, really lonely. I mean, that's the thing I hear the most in this message is just the loneliness of feeling this way. I think sometimes a diagnosis is key. Sometimes you're not going to get a diagnosis. And so the thing to do is to find people who understand being in that place. I'm on this thing called Inspire, which is like Facebook for lung cancer patients. And people talk about, you know, treatments and this, that, and the other thing. But they also just like chat. And that is really nice. The disability internet, which is like large and voluminous, and there's lots of interesting stuff on there, can be incredibly empowering. It can also lead you down some difficult rabbit holes. So that warning is up there. But I feel like the first thing that he needs to do is find some people who understand, because it's a deeply lonely place to be. And, you know, even if someone says, well, but you can still walk, the first thing that comes out of my mind in a situation like that is, well, fuck you, I can't drive. Like, you need the validation of understanding there, because that will help a lot. I don't know if Tom is in therapy, but boy, is this a case where therapy is super, super helpful. Not to be like, therapy is a prescription for everything, but someone who understands pain and understands disability can really, really speak to that.
I went 6 years without a car at one point, and I want to talk about just kind of like the logistical issues and the logistical like things that kind of impact your actual social life because you don't have a car, you know, and this was pre-Lyft and pre-Uber. This was probably from age around 23 to probably right around 29 or 30 for me. And so it meant that like there was just, and I live in Alexandria, Virginia, which again is not the most mobile area. We have the metro that takes us into DC, but the metro is more convenient for people who live in DC than for people who live outside of DC. So the idea of like having to get from one place to another was really, I was depending on the grace of people who would drive me places. And in that case, I'd have to be like, I was subject to their whims of when they wanted to take me home. And let me just tell you, like, sometimes I would take the bus and feel some sense of freedom, but that would take 2 to 3 hours to get to where I was going and was also like unreliable. So I think like the idea of him, I want to just make sure that he knows that this, what he feels, is a real feeling. Like it is a, you really feel in a lot of ways not independent. Like yes. New Yorkers are living in the laps of luxury. The fact that there are so many ways to traverse the city, but to have one disability means that if you go to a metro station and the elevator isn't working or the escalators aren't working, you're actually stranded there for folks with disabilities. So for him to be like both to have this disability and also feel like he's not able to get to where he goes, not have that sense of independence, this is a big deal. So I don't want him to walk away from this thinking that it's not. And logistically, it is a nightmare. I've been through it. It's just your life changes. My friendships changed. The people I could hang out with changed. My sense of self-worth changed. You know what I mean? So like driving really is a privilege that matters. So I don't think that sex with driving, I don't think that analogy was bad at all. I thought it was perfect.
If any listeners out there have any sense of recognition with what Tom's going through, and if there's anything you want to share with him, you can email us at deathsexmoney@slate.com and we'll pass it on, whether it's just saying, I understand what you're going through, or if you have any tips about moving around and continuing to feel connected if you aren't able to drive. So we'd like to hear from you as well. We have one final question, and this gets us back to retirement. It is from Joe, who lives in the Boston area. Let's take a listen.
I am 67 years old, mostly retired family physician, having retired from my primary care job in May of 2022. I'm married, have children, grandchildren, and have a very blessed life. My big issue in general is finding what to do in the next phase. I do a little volunteer work. I do work on a per diem, part-time basis doing urgent care. But I don't have a lot of hobbies other than skiing in the winter and bicycling in the summer. And my wife is concerned that I don't have enough to keep myself busy. Any thoughts or resources one might have to allow me to move into what would be the next phase of my life?
I love this question, Joe. And my first question is this an advice question for you or for your wife? Because I hear that. I hear that you're worried, that your wife is worried that you don't have enough to keep yourself busy without spending too much of her attention and energy. Who has something they want to offer to Joe?
This sounds actually a lot like my dad when he retired. My dad was an attorney, and he basically stayed on until they were like, you have to go, because he didn't want to have nothing to do in the morning. And he spent a year being miserable, absolutely miserable. And now he volunteers for the Innocence Project. He works on some other pro bono cases, and he has, you know, found a way to engage his intellect. But I also hear in this letter, you know, a retired family physician, that's someone who saw a lot of people mm-hmm. every day, people in different parts of their lives, people who needed advice and guidance. And these hobbies, skiing and bicycling, are not always like, hey, let's have a chat hobbies. There's got to be a way to get some people into your life, whether that's friends or new acquaintances or a club or something. You need humans. You're used to humans, and I think you need more humans in there.
My dad is a retired physician, and a thing that I have noticed, he's in his early 80s, that he's built his social life around is Rotary Club. On Mondays, it's a lunchtime thing. He hears a speaker once a week. He sees his friends. He meets people who are fellow retirees and also people who are still kind of in the most busy parts of their professional lives. And then he gets volunteer opportunities in lots of different settings. So I do think like plugging into some kind of structure like that, maybe it's, you know, a religious organization. I do think, though, it's harder to find those maybe institutions, clubs, places where people are gathering in person and making new relationships and friendships. I've felt this in my own life kind of post-pandemic. What are the best ways to plug in and feel that? So I think that it's not easy, Joe, and it might be kind of awkward, especially when you've spent your adult life being a person that people came to. You didn't have to do the effort, at least at work. They came to you and you had a service you could deliver to them and feel connected, and also like you had a purpose that was really deep and meaningful. So this is a big transition.
So I am not a joiner. I do not like clubs, memberships, groups of people making new friends. I have enough friends. I have too many friends, frankly. So I really would not pursue any of those aforementioned paths personally.
You just want to be miserable.
No, I just want to hang out with my amazing friends who I already have, and then also like read books and play with my pets and my baby. I don't like big groups of people in general. I like every gay I know goes on vacations with like 12 other gays, and they all go to Puerto Vallarta and they post these pictures on Instagram of these giant group houses, everybody like wearing matching like whatever. It's nauseating to me. And I just feel, I know that there's not any textual evidence for this, but I'm feeling vibe-wise that Joe might kind of be with me on that. And if I'm reading that vibe correctly, then I wonder if there aren't more opportunities for volunteer work in the medical field that could recapture some of what made him feel good about himself and his life during those years of work. Because I do think it can be really difficult and alienating to just up and quit when you've developed a career like that. And I know he says that he does some work part-time doing urgent care, where maybe that's more like a doc in the box. You're not developing relationships. You're not having good time to sit down and talk with patients. But I'm certain that in your area, there are places where you can help. A lot of migrants are currently being bused to the Boston area from the border who are in need of medical care, lower income people, people on Medicaid, people who might currently have no insurance. There are organizations that work to try to connect those folks with doctors. And even just your ability to sit down and talk, perhaps through a translator, perhaps not, to someone, you might be giving them their first professional medical advice that they've had in years. And that might be something that gives you that sense of meaning back in your life. And that might take some of this existential weight off of your shoulders and some of this practical burden off of your wife's shoulders.
Mark Joseph Stern, senior writer at Slate, thank you so much for joining our advice panel on Death, Sex, and Money.
Thanks, Anna.
Lizzie O'Leary was also with us. She's the host of What Next TBD. Lizzie, thanks so much for being here.
Thank you so much.
Ronald Young Jr. is a co-host of Slate's podcast Working, and if you have not already listened to it, please check out his independent podcast series, Wait For It. Season 2 is currently in production. Ronald, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you, Anna.
And I just want to say to each of you, like, this conversation has for me so much just like represented what is feels so great about joining Slate, which is this is a place where people are not afraid to have really sharp, strong opinions and tell you what they think. But it's also very clear that there's this deep warmth and care at the center of all of the conversation. And I'm just so excited to get to join you and be a part of this place. Thanks for building it in a way that we could join into this spirit.
Thank you. We're happy to have you. We're so happy.
So happy. It's a delight.
Yeah.
Welcome, Anna.
Well, thank you. Zoe Azoulay and Cameron Drews produced this episode. This is Death, Sex, and Money from Slate. I'm Anna Sale.